Welcome to Barnyard Language, honest talk about running farms and raising families. We are Katie and Arlene, an Iowa sheep farmer and an Ontario dairy farmer, with six kids, two husbands, and a whole lot of chaos between us.
While this is a podcast for farm families, sometimes our content isn't for the whole family. So kick off your boots, reheat your coffee, and join us for some Barnyard Language.
Welcome to another episode of Barnyard Language. It's Katie and Arlene doing the usual thing. Katie, I think I hear birds. Do you have windows open in your house?
I do have windows open. It was 78 yesterday, so on Sunday. It is supposed to be 75 today, and it is supposed to be 50 and raining for the next week and a half, which hopefully everybody's getting their seed in today. The guys planted oats last night, so 50 and raining might actually be pretty good. A few degrees warmer would be good, but wet is good and not freezing is good.
So the ground is dry enough to get seed in the ground, huh?
Yep.
That is good.
There's anhydrous tanks everywhere and trucks everywhere and an insane number of forage boxes going by last week. Which, since it's too early to chop anything, I don't know where they were all going, but they were going back and forth. So if anyone has an answer, I don't know why you would, but if anybody does, let me know.
What's happening in Katie's neighborhood in Iowa?
Yes, please. Well, maybe there's somewhere else in the world that people drive around with empty forage boxes a lot and can explain it.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, lamb report. You gonna look out the window? Can't see any lambs. Almost all of them are outside on the lot with their mamas running around. We've been trying to get some cute videos, but teenage boys being teenage boys, there's a fair number of interruptions for male dominant situations, shall we say, that are less than family friendly. So when I edit some video down to something that's more cute and less National Geographic, I'll post it.
Sounds good.
Yeah. It's kind of a lot.
And was there a birthday in your house in the last few days?
There was. The boy child had, I don't even know how many little kids over on Saturday. I took it as an opportunity to buy every ridiculous snack that I could find at the grocery store, including, I think, six kinds of popsicles. So far, he hasn't even noticed that he hasn't received a gift from his parents or his grandparents, because he was so excited. Played a lot of Minecraft, and thankfully it was nice on Saturday, and they ran around outside all day, and we delivered some very tired small children.
Yes, what age is he now?
He is six, which in some, like, I feel weird even talking about it, because I know this will jinx it. Some freakish turn of events, he's decided that six is old enough to get himself dressed in the morning, and like, ready. So he was actually dressed and ready for school before I came down this morning, which was very strange.
Wow. That is a milestone all in itself.
Yeah. I mean, he's wearing jammy shorts instead of undies, but the only difference is the fly in the front that he doesn't use anyway. So I guess I don't care. And he's having some real difficulties with getting the straps on his overalls on correctly, but they can be a challenge even for adults, you know, to not get them tangled up in the back.
Overalls are tricky.
But he was very proud. And we have one of those toy excavators in the yard, you know, with the seat and the handles, like you see at the playground a lot. He finally weighs enough to be able to get some leverage. So he's been digging quite a substantial moat in our yard. In case anyone was thinking of breaking in, don't, because he's booby trapping the property.
Yeah, he's gonna populate it with gators soon.
Yeah, God, I hope so. That would be amazing. Anyway, how are things in your world, Arlene?
Well, it is sunny today, but we have had a lot of rain in the last few days. So there's definitely no planting happening here yet, but things are starting to green up. You can see that the grass, with a few warm days, will start to be doing some things. And hopefully if it stops raining for a little bit, we can actually start to think about putting some things in the ground. But the way the ditches and the edges of the fields look right now, I don't think that there's any risk of us doing much planting yet, because it would just be getting stuck. So we might as well just be patient and wait a little bit longer on that one. So yeah, the waiting of spring for us right now. We're also waiting on a bunch of cows to calve. We've had a kind of a stretch of a 2 or 3 weeks, I guess, where we haven't had any babies. Normally we're pretty evenly spaced, but we had a bit of a gap there. So we've got lots who are ready to go, and we're actually milking a few less right now. So milking's pretty efficient these days. So that's kind of nice, but it'll change soon. And then we'll have some new babies to put in the calf barn. And what else has been going on? Oh, my husband and I, on the weekend, we used a gift certificate that we got for Christmas to a fancy restaurant, like the kind of place where you actually take pictures of the food, because it was like so nice. And it was a 7-course set menu, and then like the chef would come out for each course and tell you what they were serving. Oh my gosh, it was so good. It just demonstrates how amazing food can be. And also that I can't afford to eat there very often because it was so pricey, and did the wine pairing with each course and everything. But it was fantastic. But I love people who can be creative with food, especially when it feels like I've gotten in a food rut and just keep preparing the same things over and over again. So that was fun.
It's really nice, too, to get to go eat where your food is still hot. If it's your food is still the temperature that it is meant to be when you consume it, whatever temperature that is, and that there's no demands for bagels, corn dogs, chicken nuggets, cheese, whatever the food of choice is at your home, that there's no...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we're at the stage where our kids can stay home by themselves when we go out, so we told them, you know, we're going out with friends, you guys can have frozen pizza for supper, and they're excited. And actually, we are also at the stage where, instead of them being sad when we leave, our youngest was like, when are you going? We actually left a few minutes early because he was wanting to hang out with his older brothers and eat his frozen pizza in peace without his parents around. So we left even earlier than we had planned to go and do that. But yeah, we described our meal to our kids the next day, and they all said, oh, I wouldn't want to eat there. And we're like, perfect. You don't need to till you're older.
Good. Because you can't afford to.
Yeah. You can't afford it. And we enjoyed it just fine with our friends and without your company. So yeah, the first course was actually a soup that had a little scoop of like a savory gelato in the middle of it. So when you were saying about food being the temperature it's supposed to be, that one was both hot and cold at the same time. But yeah, really cool stuff. And lots of local farms that he was crediting with creating or growing, you know, some of the cheeses and foods that we were eating. So that's pretty cool too, to know that they're sourcing from local farms. So yeah, it was definitely a dining experience.
I think it's nice, too, anytime a chef shows an awareness of the fact that food comes from a place and that people put a lot of work into it. Or anytime anyone recognizes the fact that the food is not magic.
Yeah, that's right. That it didn't just come from the grocery store. Yeah, absolutely. So should we go ahead and bring on our guest for the week?
I suppose we should.
First guest from Colorado. So thank you to Sean Short, who's joining us today. And Sean, we always start our interviews with the same question. So this is your intro to our listeners. And we always ask, what are you growing? So that can be crops and livestock and businesses and kids and all kinds of other stuff. So what are you growing, Sean?
Thank you for having me here, Sean, with Blooming Health Farms. We say we're growing food and growing people. So we're actually an egg-laying chicken farm, and we raise laying hens with organic eggs, and we do some microgreens as well. We like to call ourselves an aquaponic chicken farm, which is kind of a fancy way of saying that we use fish to grow our plants and then use some of our system to grow part of our chicken feed, and then we use it to also clean up some of our wastewater as well. Most of what we do is serve our local community, direct sales, and some local small coffee shops, small caterers right now with our eggs. I never really expected fish and plants and chickens to all come into my world, but we're loving the things that come out of it. And it really just shows how farming should be synergistic and combined and stuff like that. It's fun.
That's a really interesting combination. So can you give us some context in terms of how many chickens we're talking about? So we have kind of an idea of scale. I know we always talk about chicken math being a floating number and hard to nail down, but just kind of an approximate.
Yeah, chicken math is a crazy thing. Right now we have 65 laying hens. I have a breeding flock of about a dozen with a Buckeye male and an Australorp male, and then we're breeding those two breeds. And I have about 300 young pullets in a brooder getting ready to join our flock and expand ourselves out to about a 350 layer capacity this summer. So we're expecting to really ramp up our egg laying production. We like to consider ourselves a small scale homesteading type operation right now.
So I'm guessing being in Colorado that a lot of this is undercover. Kind of how much space does it require? I'm guessing there are greenhouses or, you know, facilities. Like what does that look like in a physical sense?
Yeah. So here we're in northern Colorado on the prairie. So we definitely have multiple seasons and our chickens are on a free range system. We have them in a coop that's got both their laying or nesting boxes and their roosting area. And then we have about a 6,000 square foot yard right now that's fenced off to protect us from predators.
So Sean, I'm wondering if you get a lot of bird predation, like birds predating on your birds, We've had some losses here with hawks and eagles and owls and what your biggest predator pressures are there.
For context for your listeners out there, Greeley sits in the central flyway here in Colorado. So we have a lot of birds, just in general, a lot of migratory birds. And then we are also between two major rivers, between the Platte River and the Poudre River. So we have a lot of birds that live on the river, a lot of fishers, you know, a lot of those raptors out there that will fish. So we have a concern mostly here with hawks are our biggest aerial predators. One of the things that I do actually for aerial predation and aerial protection is I've incorporated Chinese swan geese onto our property on the edge of our flock. They're not actually in the yard or anything like that. Those geese are actually extremely observant and keen to all of those aerial predators, and I've watched them. So that is one strategy that we've used. Now, on a second level for predation, I mentioned that we have a protected yard. So we use welded wire fence and chicken wire, the heavy gauge stuff, and then usually do a couple inch down deep barrier just for the quick digs. And so we have that as the main barrier, and it's about a 7-foot fence. We do have a family of coyotes we've heard going up and down the tracks. I've seen the coons, the raccoons, I've seen the foxes. We've actually seen bobcat and mountain lion as well, tracks down in our area. So those are big concerns with us. Now the third thing that we've done. As I use these devices called Night Guard solar predator controls. And yeah, it looks like you guys might be familiar with those. I'm a raving fan of those. I think that those are one of the greatest things. I put them up on my coop. I have only four, and I've put them at the ground level for concern of the ground predators. And since we've installed those, I've seen no evidence of predation. And so for the listeners out there that might not be familiar with these devices, they are a device that you can put on a livestock area or in your gardening area that mimic predators being in the area. So essentially, it's a little box that blinks a red light, and it tricks predators into thinking that there's eyes that blink, as if you're illuminating a predator's eyes. And so the predators think, oh, somebody's in there already hunting. So those big strategies there we've had. So we've just really leaned into some of those things and those learning lessons from those predators and stuff like that.
That really leads well into our next question. So you got us there pretty easily. So when you're talking about learning and learning lessons and how you started into chickens, what is your background when it comes to agriculture? Were you someone who grew up in an agricultural area or on a farm? Were you first generation? What's your ag story?
I am a first generation farmer, I would say. So I grew up in a very prolific agricultural area. Weld County, Colorado has a very robust cattle and potato and onion industry. And there's a lot of other crops. There's probably a list of like two dozen things that we've got going on. Yet I grew up in kind of a suburban poor part of Greeley, Colorado. And I actually decided to try to grow my first pot plant when I was a teenager. And I did a terrible job. I tried to do it like under the stairs so my dad couldn't see. And, eventually he found out. And I remember looking at pictures and you can just see this big smile on my face, but you see this really, really spindly, poorly grown plant. And in that moment, I was like, I got to learn how to do this better. So I started reading a bunch of different hydroponic books and stuff like that. I came across this picture in a book of a hydroponic tomato at the Epcot Center. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, wow, we should be growing food this way. And it started getting me thinking about hydroponics, and it started thinking about all these different ideas and stuff. I recognize here in Colorado, we have a lot of seasons, and it's going to require some different strategies if I wanted to do hydroponics and stuff. So it started leading me into finding out about, greenhouse technologies and the cheap ones, the expensive ones, and all of the different things. And it ultimately led me to taking this class where I met a guy that was teaching about aquaponics. And he shared with us that he was trying to find a way to feed his family. And his wife had heard about this really clever way where you could use fish to grow plants. And it was a really closed loop, healthier ecosystem than traditional hydroponic systems that we were learning about. And at that moment in time, I think that was when I had that first aha, oh my gosh, I want to be a farmer. I want to start a tomato farm. I want to grow fish. I want to grow really good tomatoes. And this was a period in my life where I wasn't in school. I had actually failed college a couple times prior to this kind of aha moment in my life. I decided, I was like, I got to get back into school and understand this stuff. And lo and behold, I ended up finding myself enrolling at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and went to go off and study to be a fish farmer. Well, the gentleman that I was studying under to become a fish farmer, my first job was feeding fish. So it wasn't until I was like 25 years old that I had my first real exposure to agriculture. And I had to go all the way across the Pacific Island, far away from where we're doing really great things here, to even really be like, oh my goodness, I want to be a farmer and go off on this. And a lot of the work we did out there was research and extension work. It's influenced a lot of who I am today. And I never expected to take some of those things that I was thinking then and to start a nonprofit business, to have chickens and to be growing food and to be growing people.
I think as someone who also failed out of college a number of times, it's fascinating to me what happens when folks like that find the thing. Obviously, it's not that you're stupid, because, you're obviously not stupid and you were able to go and complete a degree and do the thing, but you have to find that the thing first. I really struggle with the fact that we expect 18-year-olds to know what they want to do with the rest of their lives, and to have found their thing by 18 is kind of,
And to even know what things are out there is such a big piece of it, right? Because you know, what we see in our local communities are not all the things. We don't even know a fraction of all the things that are out there in terms of the potential for what we can be doing.
That's one of my favorite things about doing the show is finding out about other people's things, because I still find out about new things that people are doing all the time. And it's, you know, it's fun.
So when you describe your business as an aquaponic chicken farm, it was making me, I was picturing like chickens like hanging out in the water like ducks, but I know that that's clearly you described your chicken situation, so that's not the case. So can you explain a little bit, kind of create a picture for us about what the hydroponics side of your business looks like in terms of, I guess just paint a picture for us, because we're not a visual medium, obviously, but yeah, describe what's going on.
I have a property in Greeley, Colorado. It's a house on about a quarter acre. It's a 9,000 square foot house. And I have slowly converted it into a aquaponics and hydroponics farm, as well as what I would call an urban homestead. So we have a house that's got an attached garage, and we have converted this garage into a vertical hydroponics system. So inside there is a 250-gallon fish tank that has about a dozen fish the size of a dinner plate. And these fish swimming around in this water are doing like what cows do or what like sheep do, and their poo goes into the water. And we use that water to water our plants. So we actually have a pump that will pump all of this water throughout this garage. Now, if you can imagine, there's a fish tank sitting in the corner of this garage, and there's a pipe that comes straight up out of the fish tank, up to the roof, and then it travels along the roof all the way to the opposite side of the room. And that water will gravity feed down into what look like bunk beds. So we have what would be a triple bunk bed of plants. These bunk beds are filled with different things at different times. Currently, right now, we are growing tomatoes. I mentioned earlier that I love tomatoes. I breed a super sweet cherry tomato, and I'm working on getting it to an heirloom status so that I can patent it. Currently, right now, we're only growing tomatoes and duckweed. So in this garage, all of this water that's flowing from this fish tank across the roof and then down with gravity through these bunk beds is recirculated back into the fish tank. The garage is completely enclosed. There's one skylight that brings in some natural lighting, and then we have artificial grow lights. We use relatively inexpensive LED grow lights that work fantastic to grow leafy greens that do the vegetative states of plants really well. So artificial lighting in a hydroponic setting is trying to mimic the sun. And one of the challenges that we have in a hydroponic industry is trying to do what nature can do so well. And LEDs offer a way to use technology to really try to mimic that light. So our lights are what are known as full spectrum lights. So they try to mimic the full color of the sun in order to grow those plants out to full. So what's really neat about our hydroponic system is that we're able to produce plants year round, which is a very, very attractive aspect of hydroponics to many producers out there when they look to incorporate hydroponics, is that you're able to control the growing cycle in different ways. And there's a lot of different ways. This is just one way that we're doing it right now. But outside on our quarter acre property, we also have a garden. We have an area where we have three or four different gardening beds that we rotate through. And we'll plant some outdoor crops. I use some of the gardening space currently to do education, to do STEM education with the community service kids that we're currently serving and some of the youth that we've been able to help. I find that agriculture and gardening in and of itself is a really great proxy, a really great, you know, subtle way to talk about sciencey things without people really thinking that they're getting a science education. And I have found, as I've been working with youth, and especially youth in our educational systems here, that they're not getting a holistic viewpoint of some of these things. And gardening or science or aquaponics or chickens or these things that we're doing allow them to make associations that they never would really expect.
Podcasts are free to listen to, but they aren't free to create. Katie and I would appreciate your support as we work to build the Barnyard Language community.
Patreon is an easy way for you to make a contribution that goes directly to making the show. As a member of our Patreon community, you get to watch the video version of our weekly updates, complete with questionable hairstyles and clutter. With three levels of support, you can choose a tier that works for you.
Keep the podcast going by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/barnyardlanguage.
So, Sean, talking about the selling this idea to more folks, as someone who, I don't know if you've seen the hydroponic tower at Chicago O'Hare Airport, they have one. It's a cool looking thing, but it's big. I have an aero garden in my kitchen right now. It's got, you know, like the six little pods. I'm growing snacks for my guinea pigs because I'm that person. Trying to figure out how to scale it. They eat a head of lettuce every day. And I mean, it's totally going to cost me more to grow my own than it cost me to just go to Aldi and buy it. But I wouldn't be who I am if I was the sort of person who wouldn't prefer to grow my own rather than buying it. How do we make, especially the smaller scale production? I mean, because I can grow a shit ton of basil in an aero garden in a space the size of my coffee pot with one little LED array. And it's very straightforward. How do we make it more than a curiosity for folks to be growing their own this way? Especially, I live in Northern Iowa. Arlene lives in Canada. You know, we live in places where green things in the winter is not super straightforward for most folks. So how do we get this into people's hands and into their homes in a way that is approachable, but also produces enough food? I mean, my six pot aero garden is cool, but it's certainly not in any way replacing anything besides my winter basil needs.
So living in a traditional agricultural area where we have a lot of soil-based agriculture, and we have seasonal agriculture, I recognize that there's some interesting aspects that I'd love to just kind of touch on for sure. So one thing that I recognize with hydroponics is that it's unfamiliar with the consumer. So the consumer is not familiar with the concept of what it means to grow plants. And so how we grow that food in and of itself, I think, is the first conversations that we really have to focus on. And shows like this and others out there that talk about agriculture are the first, I think, step to talking about how things are, how things else can be out there. Consumer awareness that these things exist and are opportunities, talking about the benefits of this stuff. So I think the first part really is to start having the awareness on the fact that these things are being done, that they are being done in popular places like at Chicago O'Hare, and then focusing on the technologies that are actually, I would say, working at that commercial scale. There's a company called Gotham Greens. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Gotham Greens. They have started to really make a name for themselves in the industry as a hydroponic supplier of leafy greens at major grocers. So we're seeing Gotham Greens in those big box stores. So they're starting to make a huge mark in the market. So I think that it requires people like me who shout from the rooftop to say, go out and buy these produces, these products and produces that these companies are making out there and taste them. Tell us what you think, talk about them, tell your friends about them. What I believe is that they will start to understand that there's something different. And I think it's that kind of that first intrinsic aspects of it that will be real impactful at first.
Arlene, I saw you raise your hand, but I'm jumping in here before we get sidetracked off onto something else. I'm just picturing, as someone who lives in a place where our Walmart sells those basil plants in the pots, and even if they look edible at the store, they're not going to be within like 3 days at home. I don't know what it is about them, but they just, And we do have some fresh herb production that I think actually is hydroponic in Iowa, so they put them in little clamshells and they ship them. And no matter how nice they look when they leave the greenhouse, by the time they get to Decorah and they've been on the rack at Walmart for a couple days or blah. But picturing what it would be like if you could have a hydroponic tower in a grocery store with plants growing, and you could just pull the whole pot out, take it home, put it in your smaller wingle-dinger at home, and just, because at home, I think it's cool to watch them sprout and do the, grow. But you do have that time gap between when you start something and when you can eat it. And if you could just go to the store and buy a tomato plant that's blooming and bring it home and pop it in, and 3 days later you'll have tomatoes. And how cool that would be, even if it's not really replacing a substantial amount of your food production. My kids are fascinated by the AeroGarden because it's doing something, and my daughter loves cutting the salad for the guinea pigs. She, takes her little scissors and cuts off plants for them. Okay, now Arlene, I'm sorry.
I was just thinking about the way that we as humans think about food production and what we want it to look like, and how you overcome that piece of people thinking that hydroponics is maybe too sciencey looking and doesn't look like the way we think our food is being produced. We all know, those of us talking here today and probably those of us listening know that there's a ton of science involved in all the food that we eat. But I think so many consumers just think it just pops out of the ground, or you just, ask the cow for their milk or whatever they think is happening, that the vision of how the food actually arrives and how it's being produced doesn't always match. And whether people have that same, kind of feeling about how their food is being produced when it looks more scientific. And I don't think that that's good or bad, but how consumers feel about it is a big part of what they buy.
Arlene, that's a really good point, because I've never seen a children's book that has, old McDonald there on his hydroponic farm, or raising fish, or...
Or even animals inside barns a lot of times.
Yeah, I've even got my overalls on today, but yeah, humans do like dirt tractors and overalls. That's what we picture.
There's an opportunity for me. I think I need to write an aquaponics children's book here, guy.
I would buy that book for my kids because they would be excited about it.
Yeah, that's right. That's
Arlene, we should hook them up with Arlen and the fish people we had on in Canada.
Hey, maybe we need to get offline and collaborate here. yeah.
I would buy that book for sure. Just saying.
I love also kind of bringing up the perspective, or at least the idea of having something in the grocery store. I know in my mind, I have a few different concepts of introducing hydroponic systems to some of our local schools. And what's really cool is they've got these shipping containers that they've turned into hydroponic farms, and they're very modular, and you can put them almost anywhere, and have, some scalable version of a vegetable farm. They also have like gourmet fish farms. And then I'm personally working on one for chickens. And so having these things available for these grocers or these schools and stuff like that, it leads me into really advocating for this idea I've thought about a lot. Is I think we need to to start decentralizing our food system more so than we have in the past, or we went towards centralization. I think especially now with the advent, or, you know, with the advantages of all of these technologies that are so easy, the precision agriculture technologies across the board in our industries, give these small scale farmers so much advantages to using these things. So I think being able to really integrate a more decentralized version of hydroponic agriculture into our communities might be one way to really start making an impact. Going back to the market garden version of the, of farming that really has, you know, sustained a lot of our farmer market industry and stuff like that. I think that, you know, having, and then at a second level, putting in these systems in those places where those people shop so they can actually see these things to help bridge that visual gap of whatever it may be or whatever like that. I think that would be a really neat idea to start seeing some of that stuff out there.
I think especially now that this is just turning into a brainstorming session, the number of folks in the Midwest, and I think through food production areas throughout North America, and I'm going to assume probably fairly globally in most developed countries, at least, the food deserts that we live in, the richest agricultural land in the world, and people can't access fresh food. And absolutely being able to have, you know, a whole system with fish and the whole thing is ideal. But if people can even grow, you know, with fish fertilizer rather than actual fish, or if you can, you know, greenhouses take a fair amount of space and you have to be relatively able-bodied to grow something in the ground, where, you know, my aero garden, you have to be able to put water in it. I mean, it's a pretty accessible system, you know, so even if you could put a hydroponic space in a church or in the public library, you know, because you could scale it to have a lot less demand for personal knowledge and experience from the farmer, you know, that it can be very modular and very, you know, put the pot in, put a seed in it, wait, food, you know, and that could really open up some avenues for folks. And if anybody needs me after this, I'll be on the Aero Garden website looking for things to donate to our library. So
I think that's a really interesting idea for that stuff. You know, hydroponics in other countries is fairly robust. In Europe, they have a lot more, you know, prolific hydroponic industry. They're growing a significant amount of their produce in like the Netherlands, in Denmark, in parts of Spain, Italy, under glass in hydroponic systems and stuff like that. So there's a model out there for consumer awareness, for consumer acceptance, and for implementation into that to bring this into these conversations that we're having here in Greeley. So according to the data, Weld County, Colorado is the 8th most productive agricultural county in the United States. But we have 1 in 5 people here do not have enough nutritious food to eat. So we live in a food desert. A significant amount of the population, a lot of the population that I've been serving with our nonprofit, lives in this food desert. And the closest fresh food that they can get is the banana on the counter at Dollar General, or the apple that's browning on the counter at 7-Eleven, and they're not able to use their food stamps to buy those things at these places. So they're going to make different choices because they have to. And I find that very disheartening, honestly, for us.
Sean, if I can touch on one more thing about the hydroponics, and then if we can take like a hard right into food justice, maybe, and talk about your other work there. I hope it didn't sound like I was saying at all that, you know, any knucklehead can grow stuff in water, But, you know, when you're talking about something where you're not dealing with soil types and diseases and weather and droughts and flooding and pests and all that other shit and huge equipment and, you know, your ability to make it accessible to more people seems much greater with hydroponics and that system. And as someone who also, the town I lived in before I moved up here and met my husband also has a JBS plant and faces a lot of the same issues that it sounds like Greeley does. So if you can tell us more about what you're doing with all these hydroponics and with your community work, because that as an Irish Catholic woman raised by, you know, descended from immigrants, I feed people. That is my thing. You know, I spent 20 years working in restaurants. Feeding people is my thing. And the idea that we have people working in processing plants, processing food in these incredible agricultural areas, and then eating browned apples from 7-Eleven it's offensive. It is personally offensive. So let's talk about how we can fix all of that. Would be great.
So as I've been talking about hydroponics and stuff, and I've touched on a lot of these different things, I've seen all of this potential, if you will. And when I see this stuff and when I've started to resonate in a lot of these thoughts, some of the first things that I asked myself is, how can I get any knucklehead to grow something with hydroponics? Because I really do truly believe that we all should be able to have more security over our food, have more control over what we eat. Food, I believe, is a right. I believe that what we put in our body sustains us. And if we don't have good nutrition, we can't be functional humans in our society. We can't think, we can't grow, we can't evolve, we can't love like we should. So I built this farm and I built this business with the idea to be able to grow food and show other people how they could do it. Here at Blooming Health Farms, we're trying to help people who want to take back their food. And I'm trying to help people who want to be homesteaders get a really good product from their chickens.
So one of the aspects of your nonprofit is also working with youth, like you mentioned. You were talking about a specific example, but I know that you are also working specifically not just in teaching people, but working with youth who have been involved in the justice system at different points in their life. Are you willing to talk about why that's important to you on a personal level?
Yeah, absolutely. Blooming Health Farms, our mission is to empower at-risk youth that are involved with the criminal justice system through agricultural entrepreneurship, to give them life skills and provide mental health support. So our mission was developed because I used to be one of those individuals. One of the biggest challenges that I had in life was that I loved to drink. I was an alcoholic for a long time in my life. I had my first drink when I was about 17 years old. It consumed me and it took a huge chunk of my life where I spent a lot of my time looking for answers at the bottom of a bottle, trying to escape from all of life's challenges. I failed out of community college the first time because I was still a professional alcoholic. And my drinking career actually led me to making a lot of poor choices that got me in trouble with the law a lot. And I would find myself in jail over and over and over and over again. And I joke now, and it's not funny in and of itself, but I tell people that I've had more mugshots and metal bracelets than I have toes and fingers. And unfortunately, it's true. But during those times of darkness, I got to be around individuals that were similar to me, that were like me, that were struggling with other areas of their life. And I got to have a lot of personal and deep conversations about other people's mental health, other people's family lives, other people's challenges, their struggles, those instances and moments in my life that started to really impact who I am today. So right now, as of recording, it's 2024, and about 7 years ago in 2017, I took my last drink, and it was a very transformative experience. It was Easter 2017, and I got extremely drunk at a family Easter dinner and got in a fight with my father, with my aunt, and a bunch of other family members. And my father asked me to leave after this big fight. So I left. I went to the liquor store, and I ended up falling asleep at a park and living there for a few days. I later learned this information after reading a police report that I was living underneath of a tree at a local park, and the local police officers came to talk to me and do a wellness check on me to see if I was alive and okay. And they called the paramedics. So the paramedics came, they tried to take me to the hospital. And in that moment, I guess I became combative and they took me to jail. I remember waking up in jail and seeing an individual that had this metal badge on his chest. And I asked him, I said, "Officer, what's going on?" He said, "Hey, Sean, you're here because you assaulted two Greeley police officers." And I immediately lost it and started bawling and crying. And I thought that I was going to live in prison for the rest of my life, and I didn't want to do that. So I actually tried to commit suicide while I was in jail. It didn't work. And it was at that moment that I promised myself and told myself that I would do whatever it takes to be a better man, and resolved that I would spend the rest of my life in prison, doing whatever it took to not let others get to where I was. It would be my mission in life to prevent other good people from making the bad choices that I made and in prison. And it was the experiences that I had in my past from being a drunk and being in and out of jail and these conversations that I'm currently talking about that started to transform my idea of how it was that I needed to help other people. And when I was listening to these individuals' stories, I started to hear that they had hopes and dreams about being really great people. They wanted to accomplish things. They wanted to love their families. They wanted to live life. And they were stuck in this room, in this white brick area, like me, unable to fulfill those dreams. So I spent a lot of my time outside of having conversations with trying to understand my legal situation. And I dove into all of the statutes and the ordinances and the laws that were related to my history, my criminal history, and my current charges at the time, so that I could try to live a better life than one in prison. Well, while I was doing all of this research, I got to learn a lot about the law. I learned a lot about my situation as well. And I actually was given a probation sentence called a deferred probation sentence, which means if I did everything they told me to, I wouldn't get these charges on my criminal record. I was offered this deal to do probation, and I showed up and I did everything that I was supposed to. And one of the things that I was struggling with at the time during my drinking career was creating stability in my life and being a mooch and a couch surfer and a vagabond with a lot of the individuals in my life. And so I saw these patterns, and I knew that if I was going to break these patterns, I had to do the exact opposite. I went and lived in a sober living house. I went and took a menial job as a food runner. I started volunteering at the food bank so that I didn't have a lot of idle time. And then I'd find myself at AA meetings 2-3 times a day early on. And it kept me busy. It kept me in this place of personal growth. And while I was going through this transformation in myself, I met an individual who is a local clinical counselor. And he told me, he's like, I've got this really neat idea. He goes, you know, when I was in grad school, I had heard about this prison down in Canyon City, Colorado, that was using an agriculture program. And he goes, yeah, what's really neat about this farm is that the prisoners that are working this program, that when they're released, they're finding that they're not coming back to prison like the other prisoners. And I immediately got goosebumps and was like, well, what? You mean to tell me that people aren't going back to prison because they're farming? And he started to just tell me a lot more about what he had learned in graduate school. Then he goes, oh, yeah, and I don't know how to do any kind of farming. And in that moment, I go, well, hey, I just graduated college, and I've been helping farmers in Hawaii learn about some of the stuff you're talking about. I'd love to get together and talk more about what you're doing. So me, him, his wife got together, had dinner, and within a week of that dinner, we formed Blooming Health Farms and developed this mission to use agriculture as a way to develop and teach the life skills for individuals and provide them the mental health support. And we wanted to focus on the youth in our community for a few different reasons. Here in our area, we are the third highest youth crime rate in the United States. And I started to think about my conversations with people in jail, and the common thread among the individuals that I talked to was that we all started what we were doing at a very young age, and that pattern continued and compounded until we found ourselves in a dire situation that was probably inescapable at that point. And so we wanted to focus on kids because we could probably break that pattern quickly because they hadn't established a history or a habit of doing things that were not healthy for themselves. And I had this experience working in a really novel and neat aspect of agriculture. Ryan had this experience working in, his background was with vocational rehab, crisis therapy. So we wanted to combine our skill sets to transform and transmute these individuals into functioning members of our community so that we could break this cycle, but help improve our community. So early on, we actually started working with some of Ryan's private clients. They needed to fulfill some aspects of community service for their court sentences. And we started to early on see that just through doing the work in and of itself, that we were transferring and teaching these kids these life skills and intimately providing them the mentorship and the mental health support while we were working around them and working with them. So these youth are helping do some of the gopher work and the grunt work necessary to do some of this, the business stuff. And then I'm subtly asking them and giving them a little bit more levels of responsibility and accountabilities. And as I watch these individuals make commitments or do the work, I'll say, okay, hey, you want to come help me collect some eggs? And then I'll get to start talking about that. You know, hey, come on into the coop. Let me show you what a roost looks like. And I'll start to just bring them in without asking them to do a lot of work. And then it allows me to do a lot of observations and assessments and stuff like that.
Sean, I want to stop you for a second. First, before we go any further, I just want, there was a lot there. And I want to thank you so much for being vulnerable and for being willing to talk about all of that, because it's not easy to talk about the places where life was really hard and where I know that you made decisions that you're not proud of, and that, you know, I know that they've contributed to who you are today, but I'm sure that if you could take a lot of that back, that you would. So I really appreciate you sharing that story with us. And it's not that it's a story. I mean, it's your life. So I really appreciate you being willing to have that conversation with us. So thank you.
You know, I wouldn't take any of it back, because I wouldn't be who I am. So, but it is. Thank you for letting me share that.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
I wanted to say too, Sean, a lot of the brightest, most creative people I know have had some substantial run-ins with the justice system. And the thing that seems to be a common denominator is that they are very bright and they are very determined and very creative. And it takes a substantial level of determination to get in that much trouble for most people. And a lot of them have found some really creative ways to get into more trouble than the average person would. And I was reading your book and, you know, talking about at the beginning, you were talking about the business plan that one of the kids you were working with had come up with, that was, you know, if we can make this much money off this many chickens, we could make more money if we had more chickens. And how much we gatekeep things like having a business, where that's a totally valid business plan. And if we can redirect, especially these young people who have maybe had the chance to go through the justice system once or twice instead of spending, you know, 20 years going through it, towards using that creativity and that persistence and that curiosity seems to be the other sort of defining factor for a lot of these, at least a lot of the folks I know. You know, what happens if I do this? What happens if I do this? Like in farming or like physics experiments or cooking or whatever. Cool. If you're talking about drug usage or breaking into people's houses, less cool.
But it's the same brain functioning, right? Exactly. Yeah.
Be able to redirect that. Oh, it's the same brain, but it's like that, was it Spider-Man, that with great power comes great responsibility, that you got to channel that towards something less likely to end you up in front of the judge, hopefully.
The way that you talk about all the different things that led you to where you are today, it does seem like all that creativity and passion and determination is... it all intertwines into your work. So we are a parenting podcast, I think you know. And one of the things that has come up for me as you've been talking is I feel like you have a really unique perspective for any of us us as hosts or listeners who maybe have young adults, teenagers who might be going down the wrong path or are doing things that we're concerned about, or their friends or, you know, other young people in our lives that we're worried about. Do you have any insight into ways that we as parents or adults in those young people's lives can help them to channel their energies into productive and positive ways so that they don't get themselves into trouble?
I think that at the back of all of it, we must all remember that we've all been kids. We've all had an experience of being one and being around them. And we need to be able to sit and be aware that we can reflect on those things and they exist in our lives. Because I think often we forget that we were kids and we made mistakes and we had fun and we had not fun and we had dreams and we got hurt and we got scared and we had all of these things that happened on. And I think that oftentimes kids being very impressionable individuals take what adults say with a lot of weight. We are a product and a sum of everything around us. And as kids, we're sponges. We take in everything all the time. And I've done it myself personally and seen others, individuals out there, when kids say things or do things, some of our first natural inclinations is to make a definition about what's going on, define it in our perspective. And once we start to define things for kids from our limited perspectives, we start to develop a framework that they live in. And I think some of the things that we can do as adults is, first, don't give an answer right away. Take pause in the interactions that we're having with our youth, with our kids. You know, they look differently at young adults. But first and foremost, just kind of take pause and process and be aware that there's something coming out of their brain that's going to be new, novel, unique, or maybe you've heard it before, but it's there. And then we have our experiences of being kids and within as much time as reasonably allowable, try to put those two together in that moment and letting them kind of come to some of those realizations. It's been really profound and impactful for kids to let them start to understand the world and stuff like that. We have to be okay with being a youth at the different levels and engaging with them on some of their interests at a different level. I will play video games with some of these kids, the current cool video games. I've been playing Roblox and Minecraft with a kid. I don't know much about that, but we had fun. We build. We get to bond. We get to do these things in different ways. And as many of you out there may see in your world all over, we're so inundated with technology and smartphones have consumed our lives and our kids out there and youth. And me, myself, I get trapped and sucked in to staring down at this little tiny digital screen. And one thing that I have started to explore and start to do is, how can I get them off of that? How can I get them away from looking at these devices as often as possible without it making it feel like I'm taking a security blanket away from them, or that I am not allowing them to explore something that actually has a lot of potential? So I don't want to negate some of those things as well too. And so just being open and curious about those things. I know you mentioned it earlier, Katie, that curiosity is what really, I think, unlocks a lot of these aspects of these different things. And so encouraging us to, you know, being in that kid mode, what is it I want to do that maybe I can go do with this kid that doesn't actually know what they want to do in life, and go explore some of those things.
Thank you. Those are some really, really good things to keep in mind and to think about all of our interactions, right, with our kids and our youth, to think about how powerful our words. You know, sometimes it feels like they're not really listening, but a lot of the time, just, you know, a little comment here or there can really make a big difference. So to be more conscious of our interactions with all the younger people, well, and adults too, with all the people that we interact with on a daily basis, is really good. Those are some really good reminders. Katie, I feel like we could talk for about a million years, but I think we should wrap it up. I feel like Sean might have to come back again someday, but I don't want this episode to be about 6 hours long. So do you want to go into our last question? And I think I might, for the first time, even cut out our cussing and discussing segment, just so we can have this whole conversation be the entire episode, because I just love where we went today.
We could make it a 15-part series, Arlene. All right. So Sean, we ask all of our guests, if we were going to dominate a category at the county fair, what would it be? And categories can be real or made up to ensure that you win.
So we would dominate what I call chicken sprouting.
I'm just picturing you like planting little tiny
little chickens,
like the robin's eggs you get at Easter, and like boop, 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 and then they would grow into bigger eggs, and then boop, boop. I'm sorry. Now that we've gotten deep into how my brain works.
Well, I think a better category name would be, I'd like to dominate the homestead chicken category. I believe in taking back our food. I believe in taking back our sufficiency and sustainability. And I think that chickens offer all of that. And I want chickens in everybody's lives. So I've got to dominate the chicken category here at the county fair with getting chickens into your lives.
Definitely. So we want to thank you, Sean, so much for joining us on the show today. Katie already referenced your book, and I've been listening to your podcast. So why don't you tell our listeners where else they can find out more about you and your farm and all of the work that you're doing?
Come check us out over at www.bloominghealthfarms.com and sign up for our newsletter. I love sharing what's currently going on and some of the successes and setbacks that we've had. So at bloominghealthfarms.com, we've got a lot of the information about the different services and products that we have. So that's really the best place to come check me out. The other great thing that Katie and Arlene have mentioned is Thinking Outside the Soil, my book that shares how hydroponic fodder is helping farmers save water, improve livestock quality, and helping us all become better stewards. That's available at thinkingoutsidethesoil.com. And also on Amazon in all of the different formats, whether you love to read, you love to listen, or if you like to look at it on your smartphone when you're in between doing your things. So come check us out at Blooming Health Farms and see what we've got going on over here.
Thank you so much. It was great to chat with you.
Thank you, ladies. It's great to be with you as well.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you for joining us on Barnyard Language. If you enjoy the show, please support us on Patreon with a donation.
Big thanks go out to our show editor, Krista Paffrath, at the Rural Podcast Network.
Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen and follow the show so you never miss an episode.
If you want to connect with other farming families, join the private Barnyard Language Facebook group.
We are always in search of future guests for the podcast. If you or someone you know would like to chat with us, get in touch.